thank James Henry Bedell once again for the great musical intro. On this episode of Climate Champions, I talk to the co-founders of Pi Energy, Phil Layton and David Andreessen, about their transformational plasmonic solar technology that will significantly lower module cost, lower the cost of installation, and substantially increase the viable surface area for electric generation. Phil Layton and David Andreessen, welcome to Climate Champions. I'm excited to talk to you for two reasons. One is I've known Pi Energy a while. I'm really excited by the technology, but I will let you talk about that. And the second is it's the first time I'm interviewing two people, so it should be an interesting dynamic. Since this is a very technology-focused company, I would like you to talk a little bit about the technology and what the company does.
Yeah, so the technology is based on a new way of looking at how you capture light. So originally, everybody's thinking of light as this particle. And if you change your approach, you look at it, oh, it's actually a wave and a particle, there are ways to capture it differently and more efficiently. So the concept is capturing that wave nature of light and using materials that actually do a better job at it than the way we've been doing currently, semiconductors. So our technology is based on capturing the light and then compressing it and having very high energy concentrations and then being able to separate it. So we built this very diverse team, but starting from this, what's called plasmonics, and being able to take that, and the goal is to make an inexpensive solar collector. But it's starting from a different perspective. Our end goal is we believe, and I'm going a little bit out of it, is we need to make a business case for global climate. We need to make it something that people want to do because it's just in their own self-interest. It's so cheap and inexpensive.
One of my taglines, if you will, that I used to say, and I guess I still say at conferences, is that maybe we should do it because of climate change, and maybe we should, you know, the new energy, and maybe we should do it for energy independence, and there's a lot of reasons maybe we should do it that I think are good reasons, but in the end, it always comes down to economics.
Yes. Yeah, and that's exactly it. There are a lot of people want to just do it because that's in their core, and I think David and I are in that. But if you really want to make a change, you need to have it. So everybody wants to do it for their own interest. It's got to be, I am buying this product or I'm doing this. Maybe it's great for the environment, but it's also a lot less expensive or it's more convenient for me. And that's the way to make a difference.
So, David, you use the wave, not the particle, so you just ignore the particle, or you...
Phil's talking about the first part, the absorption, absorbing it as a wave, which is a fundamental difference in photovoltaics. The first photovoltaic device that was patented was in 1941. The patent that was filed still describes the majority of PV installed on our planet today. So that was about 6 months before Pearl Harbor. And if you really want to scale renewable energy to the terawatt level, to a global scale, to have a truly sustainable civilization, you have to have PV which is really cheap. It's not cheap enough for somebody in New York or Los Angeles, but it has to be cheap enough for somebody in Dhaka, Bangladesh, or in Nairobi, Kenya, without a subsidy. So that means you have to revisit the core assumptions of PV, because solar is the most abundant energy source. And if you're going to have a sustainable civilization, it has to be not just a feel-good technology, it has to be low cost. Otherwise, it will not scale because of the practical realities of our global economy and our current civilization. So Phil's perspective and the innovation that he started is a fresh look at the fundamentals of PV. And originally, it seemed fairly heretical. I remember when he first proposed this, and he started talking to people outside the company in, say, 2008, it was, I would say, the majority of experts in the field first would have no clue what he was talking about, and second would question the basic principles. Now, you can see the orthodoxy as far as solar innovation starting to turn in this direction. There's still a long ways to go, but this is a fundamental innovation to something which is really important for human civilization.
Now, you have said important for human civilization, and Phil, you previously said that you're a believer, I'm paraphrasing, in the mission in addition to the cost. So can you talk about your aha moments? In other words, the moment where you understood how important climate change was and that it was what it was that you had to engage?
Yeah, I think, you know, as a kid, I always, growing up in Southern California, I always experienced the smog, and that always bothered me. So that was just the immediate, you know, you're aware of the pollution, you know it's bad for you growing up. Really looking at it at from the climate change, that not only is this a temporary pollution, but this is a long-term problem for my kids. I went to a Scripps Institute, one of the early discussions they had for the public here with my dad, and they started talking about the long-term effects. This is not something that, like pollution, you can scrub away or it goes away with the rain. This is something that once it's out there, you really can't get it out of the system. And then just the fundamentals that the CO2 is like a blanket, and once it's there, you know, they start going through the calculations, and I think it's also iterative. You know, that's kind of an aha moment, but then as you go through, you realize, you see more data, then it's like, oh, this is worse than I thought. You thought, oh, the clouds will help, there's some other, but as we start looking at the data, it's both the aha and the constant new papers and analysis that's out there that has been reiterating the urgency of it.
That's a very good point, that ongoing aha, because I think I could go back in time to where maybe I had my first aha moment, but really when I met David and he started explaining the deeper science to me and some of what was going on the planet today, that really got me going. So even though I was already aha'd, I still consider that quite an inflection point for myself. So thanks, David.
Sure.
And why don't you talk about your aha moment?
So I think I started tracking climate changes as an issue probably at the tail end of the Cold War. It was a serious issue. And we had James Hansen speaking, testifying to Congress in the 1980s. Let's remember, there was a time there at the end of the Cold War where people were talking about an ice age, an impending ice age. So our understanding of climate dynamics has evolved tremendously. So I would say our uncertainty back then was over 90%. The problem is, even today with the feedback loops of the greenhouse effect, what in climate science might be called the radiating force and components, it's only understood maybe about 60%. So if you speak with folks at the Keeling Lab at Scripps or other leading research groups in climate science, it turns out the unknowns, if you look at the IPCC report, Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the physical science report, the error on half of the inputs and the feedbacks is significant for over half of the system. So from a planetary perspective, half of the risk is not properly characterized. This is a big problem, which means we don't know what the timeline is for disruptive climate change. So I realized this a couple decades ago, that we didn't know this, what we didn't know. And what gave me the aha moment that we're running out of time is when I saw a satellite image taken by, I believe it was a NASA image that I believe I saw. It was a hydrogen sulfide bacterial bloom off the coast of Namibia, and it was the size of a country. This is a large, vast area of the ocean that happens only if you have very high temperatures. And this is a telltale sign of things are going very bad in the climate. These types of events dominated our planet in the Permian-Triassic mass extinction, which was way worse than the KT extinction. So when I saw that image, I thought, this is a very bad sign. I need to do more. This was probably around 2005, 2006. Frankly, it scared me.
But do you have any more personal reasons why it's important to you?
That's intensely, intensely personal. It has to do with what you value in your life. So valuing life itself and civilization is a worthy cause, and everybody wants to have their life mean something. And I think protecting from an impending damage, where we don't know what the timeline is, but it's definitely coming, is worth rearranging your life around. And I think Phil and I are in the same boat there, where we could have pursued careers, we could have stayed in our careers, where it was financially much more beneficial, but personally, ethically, it was clearly a choice. You know, are you going to make a lot more money and go on your merry way when you know that this impending risk is coming closer and closer? So I think in both our cases, we decided that we valued life and everything that we have on this little dot, blue dot in space called Earth, more than something like short-term monetary benefit, which, you know, it's nice to have things, but I think it's better to do something which is meaningful. And then there's the angst of realizing, wait, you have this information that you're seeing, that there's this very nasty event that's going to happen, climate catastrophe. And if you're able to contribute to avoiding that, not doing so would be highly reprehensible.
Okay. I understand that motivation. It's almost backwards, right? That if you don't do something, you're a fault, so you have to do something. Phil, any personal drivers for you that are very important?
Yeah, I think David did a very good job. It's the same thing. You know, with personal fulfillment, he nailed it on the head. It's, you feel better about yourself if you have a purpose. And it goes beyond that, in that, you know, having kids, realizing what's your legacy on this planet? Were you just here? You had a lot of toys and then you die? Or do you do something meaningful? And I feel better waking up every morning knowing that I'm trying. I'm actually, maybe I don't succeed today, but by being here, did I leave the planet a better place for my kids and the next generation, you know, great-grandkids? And I just, you know, personally, it's the selfish part. I feel better knowing that I'm trying. It's a hard battle. There's a lot of struggles. This is not an easy thing to do. But not only do we need to do something, but from a personal level, I feel the same way I think David does. You know, I have to. There is that guilt,
Yeah.
But there's also the personal satisfaction that I feel better knowing that every day that I'm trying, that I'm trying to leave this a better place than, and if I have the tools to do it, I'm going to do it, you know, use all the different things, the life skills that I've learned.
So I enjoy everything you said, but my favorite part of that was have a lot of toys and then you die.
They bury you with the toys.
Yeah. You don't get to take them with you. So.
No, yeah. You don't. So both of you have very similar motivations. So I think sounds like a very nice partnership from that perspective. How did you guys meet?
It's actually interesting. Sometimes we try to remember, you know, as you get older, you go, was it here? I remember, and I think this is slightly gay, we were introduced back when I was starting another company. I had a virtual keyboard company that was a little too early, and David was working on a company too, and this person at the
San Diego
RTA said, you guys should meet.
Caring Wedding,
right. And then so it was, I remember it was some rainy day and we met. Now, where I thought it was La Jolla.
Starbucks.
And he thinks it's over here. And I thought it was over in La Jolla. But, you know, you mix those two up. He's saying that and I'm remembering some other.
I'm 2 years younger.
That's why
I remember.
The old married couple. Yeah.
Yes, it is. Yeah. I'm 2 years younger, so my memory's better. Anyway,
but anyway, so, you know, part of it, we just had a good we weren't sure how, but we started working together on, you know, David was more in the finance, I had my legal and technical, you know, science background, and we both had the same interest. David was, you know, had his technical background, so we just had a lot to talk about, and we, you know, this is before we're talking about climate change, too, so this
I actually think, okay, so you spoke to Karen Wedding, and I spoke to her, and she told me, because we both spoke to her about sustainability, about climate, or concerns. This was like 1999, 2000. And she told me, you guys are the same flavor of crazy. Okay?
As I sit here, that is what I was thinking. That word was in
crazy,
my head.
Yeah.
So, and I remember in our first discussion, we talked about photovoltaics.
Oh, yeah.
And we spoke about thermonuclear fusion, tokamak. So, similar flavor of crazy. Mine has more tapatio and cholula, and his is more bland. But we like him nonetheless.
He just called you bland.
He called me bland.
Okay, let's... let's move on. Can you tell me about, and this is for either one of you, any kind of rock bottom moments, hard times that you've had to persevere through?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's interesting. As you go through this, there's always multiple ones. You just go through and go, this is the rock bottom, but then there's always new opportunities for difficulties. And, you know, there's the finance. There are disagreements, and usually whenever we had a disagreement, it's like we agree, but we're saying it in a different way. You know, that's always the one person saying, but I'm saying this, and you're saying that, but we're actually agreeing usually.
Yeah.
And it's just, the difficulty is there's all the dynamics of going through this. There's the pressures of bringing finance in, we have the pressures of trying technically, you know, things come and go with both technical and the finance, and they don't always line up when you need them to. So, but anyway, that's not a specific, but.
But I think it's interesting because I wasn't really thinking about the rock bottom moment being a personal thing between the two of you. I was thinking more for the company.
It's not that, but it's just, you know, it's a district, you know, but, you know, with everything we have. You have a disagreement, and it's usually not really that much of a disagreement. So then we work it. We always work it through, and we, you know. So anyway, go.
Yeah. I, So, and of course, I have to disagree about the disagreements that Phil just mentioned, because
when we have
a disagreement, it's because he's using the wrong fonts. Mm.
Oh, that's a joke.
But the rock bottom moments are definitely, I would say, in the development, and as Phil and the team are navigating off the map into the unknown of this physical reality to discover the exact details on how to have a better solar technology, sometimes you can't fool Mother Nature. So sometimes you run into challenges where you may have put a lot of effort and you have to backtrack, make a turn at the fork in the road and go the other way. And it's very, very challenging. And this is a multi-year process. The other huge rock bottom source is finance, corporate finance, because unfortunately in the United States, when it comes to renewable energy, I'm not talking about incremental innovation in energy, like a better way to drill a natural gas well or a slightly more efficient combustion engine. I'm talking about something that's really disruptive. There's very little capital available. If we were either in the People's Republic of China or in Western Europe, there's a lot of capital available for what I would say is not very interesting or fundamental innovation. In the US, this has been cut quite a bit from the government funding and from the private sector when it comes to PV, solar energy, photovoltaic solar energy, because of the smoking craters that sucked up and obliterated a lot of capital over the past 10 years. I'm talking Solyndra, Mia Soleil, NanoSolar. I mean, Solyndra is the classic example. That's almost like a dirty word in some circles or an example of waste. So there's a very little interest in fundamental innovation to solar. And this has been a great challenge to us. So many times we have to, unfortunately, go outside of the US to find investors because they won't have these biases. But you go down the road, you spend months cultivating this relationship. It's almost to, you know, a transaction. And sometimes things don't pan out. And that's like getting the rug pulled out from under you. And at the same time, you're trying to run faster to get to this technical goal of having a commercial product. So I think corporate finance and development are definitely rock bottom points. But you have to continue.
Yeah. Since that was the hard stuff, tell me about your biggest success.
Surviving. Going forward.
Oh, specific success.
Specifics. Yeah. Without an NDA?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, there are those
without signing an NDA.
There are those moments where one of our group will come in and says, you know, this, it wasn't working for, and all of a sudden it is, and we would have this major improvement in the efficiency. And we weren't, you wouldn't expect it. And then I'm dancing around it because it's all, I can't go through the proprietary stuff. But we did have a couple where it's all of a sudden we'd have these order of magnitude improvements and it was totally unexpected. And, you know, the hard part is you really want to just say, get excited about it, but you know you have a hard road ahead. So I usually am more reserved. And David will
and
say,
David, you mean?
Celebrate. And I'm just going, all right, we just have to keep moving forward. But, you know, there are those moments that we get that are very satisfying that we finally got some. Because there's been a lot of trial and error, and you just have to keep moving forward. You know, like Edison had to deal with the light bulb. And everybody thinks of that. Oh, yeah, he tried a lot of stuff. And you don't really personally understand what trying lots of stuff is, how hard that is, and how long it takes, and emotionally draining that you have all these failures that just aren't working. Or you have the two steps forward and that one step back. So when you do get that one step forward, it is very satisfying. But you, along with it comes that really hard slog forward that you're just trying. Those moments when they do come out are particularly rewarding.
You know, I'm very lucky because David doesn't like to call me with bad news. So I get the news when it's very good news and he wants to come over, wants me to come over and have a beer at the brewery company right over here.
Yeah.
You know, so I get the good stuff, but when I don't hear from him for a long time, I know it's bad news time.
So Phil and I divide the euphoria in stoicism, because when we have a technical victory, Phil gets very stoic and he says, "Oh, that's good, but we've got lots of work to do." And I think, "This is great. We're going up the mountain. This is fantastic." Now, on the other hand, when we have a corporate finance event where we get some funding from an investor, Phil gets euphoric and I get stoic.
He knows he has a lot more work still to do.
Because I'm just looking at the next challenge.
Yeah,
that's great. Hey, what about a vision for the future? I'm going to talk about where you see the world in 5, 10, 20 years, whatever time frame you want.
I see it, my dream is that we're in balance. The human race is in balance with nature. We're not over-produce CO2 that we find. And part of that is there's the technical challenges, but there's also the human as a species recognizing that we need to be in balance. And I see, I'm encouraged by the younger generation is realizing this. And my kids and a lot of their friends are realizing how important it is to be in balance with the system we're in. We can't just keep on consuming. And I see it as we're there as a species in balance with all the other organisms on this planet and not destroying it, but working together. And that's complicated with all the how we do that, but that's a summary.
Okay, so what do I see as far as the future? Assuming we hit our milestones, we have low-cost solar energy and low-cost energy storage. Okay, so those are my working assumptions, and I believe they will happen. Okay, in the next 10 years, we're going to have globally scalable technologies. It's going to require investments, I'm going to count on market-driven solutions. No subsidies, no incentives. This has to be driven by raw capitalism, because that's how our civilization works at this point in our history. So I would expect that over the next 20 to 30 years, we have a civilization where you've got our primary energy is renewable and fossil fuels stop being used, not because of restrictions, but because of the cost. Won't make sense. And then not only do you have, you transition to a sustainable civilization where you're no longer degrading your environment every year, but you have the benefits of better health and a stable climate, there's an additional benefit to national security globally. Because if you distribute the ability to generate electrical power and energy globally, all of a sudden you pull billions of people out of poverty and into modernity so that everyone can have a quality of life like we have here in this country.
And it creates new opportunities for...
creates new markets for our country. But globally, it's much more stable.
You know what? I think you may be going here, but what you haven't stressed is the distress that the limitation on energy causes in the world.
Yeah.
A lot of people would say many of the wars that we fought had their basis in protecting energy concerns.
Mm-hmm. And resources. So once you have, I mean, in a planet where you've got resource issues go away, you have 3D printers where you can make your toys that you need, and you've got the globally connected intelligent civilization internet, and then you've got the energy to make these things. It's a whole different planet.
Yeah, that
the and more it involves everybody, and people aren't going without water, without food.
You talked about less expensive solar. So, what are you thinking? A kilowatt hour of solar, or a watt? What do you think a watt
you just will disclose
go for?
Your cognitive bias as a grid guy. So, for the listeners,
all six.
Lee has a long history in the power sector. So, grid. So, I think the next step of our civilization is not going to be mostly grid connected. I would say it's going to be a world covered with microgrids, which are probably DC in the short term, and then to exchange energy through a market system between these microgrids, AC. That would be my guess, which means you have energy storage and electronics that are DC.
What about my refrigerator?
Have DC for refrigerator.
I know they have them. I've seen them. They don't have many features.
Well,
not yet.
Just give it time.
Not yet.
You know, you have to start somewhere.
You should have seen the first iPhone.
I'm not saying we won't get to DC, but I think we'll get to AC microgrids.
Yeah. That's a minutia, but in the end, it's microgrids, whether they be AC or DC.
The reason I asked about cost is because, and you're right, some of it is my bias, but we import panels, and the price that we pay per watt is one of the metrics of who we buy from and how much is purchased and what price can ultimately be energy can be delivered at. So that's why I was curious. Yeah.
So how
much you're going to beat the current.
So if you want to have a sustainable civilization, you need to, if you're able to cover all roofs, all residential roofs on the planet, you get about 18 terawatts of power average. Okay? That does not include commercial and industrial. Now, let's say you're going to do that. That means you're going to have to install rooftop solar on every house on the planet. Do you think an average person in South Asia or Africa can afford what it costs to have rooftop solar, tens of thousands of dollars on the roof? No, it has to be one-tenth of that or less.
That was my point.
That is our target. That's why my energy is interesting.
The other part about it is moving to beyond just the grid applications. You have the mobile applications, so it's the source of demand. If you can provide the energy, and this is where you get to the DC, you don't have to go and put the AC infrastructure in. You go straight to the source. If it's sitting there collecting, there's a lot of small mobile devices that you can boost their power. Some of them can get all their power from light. Others can't, but you can boost it. But you go straight to the demand. You can put these, so then the cost starts going down.
Yeah.
The people have those little mini iPhone chargers with a battery. You know, that's kind of the approach where you start having, that's the essence of microgrid for a solar charge.
I'd say five years from commercialization, we'd like to see that. Or so one-eighth.
To me, that says one-eighth would say about a nickel for the watt. A nickel on the watt, and then the rest of the system would have to be similarly one-eighth.
That is our goal.
But if you can do that, now you can make hydrogen in a more cost-effective way, which now you have some long-term storage, and you don't need maybe lithium-ion batteries to find a way to reduce costs by another 90% because you have another way to do it.
Yeah, one of the interesting things is we won't have all the market solutions. Our goal is to provide that, like you're saying, is that then there's going to be a lot of people saying for hydrogen storage, there's applications out there that we haven't thought of, but bringing the cost down, the form factor is actually very important. Having this non-toxic, very lightweight. There's new applications where it doesn't matter. The 5 cents isn't critical. It's the fact that it's lightweight, yeah. non-toxic, easy to place on a device, and it's performance.
You also can help the water situation.
Right.
If you have cheap energy.
There's a lot of synergies in there with.
Yeah, there's a couple billion people on the planet which are drinking water they shouldn't be drinking.
Yeah.
And if you have this type of technology, you enable, you reduce healthcare costs for a couple billion people.
Yeah.
That's a huge benefit.
And then there's the capital cost. You know, if I have to pay for a generator and the diesel and transport it all the way to these remote locations where a solar panel is perfect for that. So it goes beyond just the cost.
That can be done right now.
Yeah.
At a lower price.
But
with
you have
current
a large,
technology.
Yeah, but a large solar panel that costs a certain amount that, you know, and transport of those panels actually. There's some interesting, you know, seeing somebody carry a large solar panel on some back road area, that there's some issues with that too. So.
All right. Any questions for me before I go back to you? You'll have one last chance, David.
I have, you
look very anxious.
Yeah. So Phil talked about carrying the solar panels. He's talking like crystalline silicon. You've got 5 strong individuals carrying a typical panel. What we want to see is an average-sized human that might weigh 100 pounds carrying a roll of Pi Energy module rolled up. That person, she can install it herself without an electrician. Maybe she's an electrician, but it should be something that she can install. Now, that just changes the game.
It changes the game for energy.
Totally.
No doubt. This company, Orison, and they make a plug-in battery, but that's safe to plug in and actually use potentially for a little mini microgrid for your home or for storage to do arbitrage. And I think the smallest one weighs 40 pounds, which is very heavy, and that is a limitation. But the exciting thing is that it does allow you to do self-install, which is a big breakthrough. Energy storage.
And each one of those improvements enable. So, you know, we're part of the puzzle. The storage is the other part. And as each one...
And software. Don't forget software.
But each one of those feeds on themselves. So nobody's going to develop the battery until they have, you know, the right PV. As you provide the PV, the battery solutions also, they have new capabilities and solutions will be out there too. So I think each one of them feed on each other to create new markets. So the exciting part is this is a business opportunity for others. If you want to grow the economy, you provide new, you know, you look at computers, you know, it's starting to peter out. You're not getting the growth curves. This is an opportunity for others out there, and it helps with the global climate. But as you create these new developments, there's new economic potential. It should be exciting to everybody. So,
It grows the market. In the 1950s, the size of the mainframe computer market was 5 units for the United States. Today, the size of the computer market, if we include our smartphones, is about 6 to 7 billion potential market. When I was 8 years old, I had to choose a gift. I could either have a bicycle or a calculator. Guess what I picked?
Well, you're an odd guy, so I'm going to say a calculator.
That's correct. I'm a knucklehead. So now they're disposable. We need to get to a point where solar panels are almost low cost that they're that could almost be disposable
or
recyclable.
You're just saying that because you want them to order more of your product.
Yeah.
Well, solar panels, they're not going to impact our civilization. Climate trajectory until they become so cheap that they're almost disposable, and you can also install them on almost every surface. And
recyclable.
That's what I mean.
That's good.
We're
good.
Not create a new problem.
Okay. So turnabout is fair play. Yeah. Do you have any questions for me?
So what's next for you?
What's next for me? That's not the kind of question I had in mind. I'm doing what's next for me. I am just trying to, like you, help mitigate climate change. And I started this podcast hoping that I could do that by interviewing champions, climate champions, and getting the word out there, as many words as I can, not just my word, but try to get different perspectives on this, what different people are sacrificing and doing to create change and to help solve problems. So this is actually my passion right now, these podcasts and improv comedy. And David has come to see a show. Phil, I'm still waiting.
And my son wants
to see. I know your son does improv comedy. Yeah,
he wants to see. He's very excited.
That's great. So, hey, is there anything
else? I have two questions.
Two people, more questions.
Yeah. So climate, I'm glad you changed it from heroes to champions because that's less heroic. But I think why didn't you call it climate masochist? Because that's really what this is about.
I think it's pretty much a synonym.
Okay. Now, my next question is, in the U.S., this is a big challenge for me because we are we're a California-based company. And it is so challenging to get people interested in solar innovation. Fundamental innovation versus incremental fine-tuning. What do you think is the biggest challenge for the investor community as far as getting involved in real sustainability with regards to next-generation clean energy?
I think investors do want that very much, but they are protecting their investors. So they are investors, but they are having others give them venture to invest. And so they are trying to increase their expected value of whatever investments they make. And I've spoken to some CEOs of venture companies that are looking at earlier technologies, but you're probably even too early for most of them because the risk is there when it's early. So I think they'd rather come in late, at least what I'm seeing, is they'd rather come in when it's later, when it's more about commercialization, and they can leverage their current connections and networks to make that happen. But it just feels like a lot of risk when it's still in discovery about will the science work and how well will it work and how much will it cost and will you get to the end game?
Yeah, if you want something new, I think it has to be different. So you're not going to find innovation in a well-trodden path.
I agree with you. I'm just explaining why people.
Yeah,
I'm not a believer of big incentives for companies that are trying to make it when they have product and they're competing. I like to see them compete, but I am a believer of incentives when it's very early technology that otherwise would have trouble finding investors, but is in the incentors, whether it's a country or a state, if it's in their best interest to have a breakthrough, a transformational technology win, to me, that's where the incentive should go to make change happen.
Yeah, my frustration is that if you're talking about energy, as you know well, this is unlike a website that takes a few days or weeks to put up. When you're talking about energy innovation, this takes 8 to 10 years of committed capital and team, and I wish our country was more supportive of such an effort, which is ultimately to the benefit of the United States as well as the world.
Well, there are times when the country is more helpful and times when it's less helpful. And I think that's cyclical like everything else. And with that, is there anything else you would like to say before I wrap it up?
Thanks for having me.
All right, so I'm going to wrap it up, but I'm going to wrap it up with a rap. Okay? David and Phil, they're sitting in a tree. They're trying to use plasmonics to replace PV. They certainly are selfless guys. They gave up a lot of toys before they die. They're trying to get us out of a pickle, but they won't just come out and say it'll be under a nickel. I'm so excited about your technology, I just want to rave. You said the heck with the particle, let's check out the wave.
Ooh, good one.
Awesome.
true. I called David odd, but he called himself a knucklehead, and he called me a grid guy. And yes, Phil talked about his toys, or lack thereof, more than his technology. But Pi's fundamentally innovative transformational solar technology gives me real hope we can mitigate climate change.